Welcome to VoiceOver, Movies That Move Us. I'm your host, Heather Bigley, and I talk to people about the movies that made a mark, led what you might call cinematic epiphanies, taught something important, revealed a new way of being in relationship, created a space for self-reflection, touched people emotionally and spiritually. And it's not always the movie you'd expect. Today's movie is a recent blockbuster from 2024, Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. Produced for almost $200 million, the film and theatrical release made $715 million worldwide. So, yeah, a blockbuster. If you weren't one of the millions buying a ticket back in 2024, let me explain the plot. The young hero of the film, Paul Atreides, narrowly escapes an assassination attempt that destroys his entire household, leaving him and his mother abandoned in the desert. Paul joins with the Fremen, the despised indigenous people of the planet that his own people have colonized, and under Fremen protection, he plots revenge. And today's guest is Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith podcast, where he talks to people of all religious traditions about their experience with God. Before In Good Faith, Steve had a career in music composition and performance, as well as TV and playwriting. Steve is also a fellow sci-fi fan. So, you know how this works. If you are made nervous by spoilers, go see Dune 2 and then come back for this episode, because we're going to talk through all the plot points end to end. Remember to stick around after the convo for some recommendations. Steve, last year when Dune 2 came out, you went to the movies how many times to see it?
I saw it twice in the theater. And then while babysitting my granddaughter after she was in bed, I watched it two other times.
There you go. Okay, why?
Because the story, because I had connected so much with it as a teenager, had read them again in my late 20s, early 30s. And then just that I felt that the movie adaptation was so successful in telling a coherent story. And I was okay with things just falling away left and right that could have been included or that were cool in the books, but weren't the story.
Yeah.
I was just so impressed with something that just felt so huge and visionary. But the story itself is the story of figuring out who you are and the story of choices. And that's what I loved. I was not left with a clear lesson. You know how they say, don't complete the circle. Like you go up in front of someone on a board and you go, you draw about three quarters and everyone who's watching you knows where it's going. It's the idea of leave something for the viewer to do. And I felt like Denis Villeneuve left stuff for me to do. Sometimes in the acting that could have been much more blatant or obvious. Sometimes in the storytelling. My mind was given lots to do, to fill in the gaps or finish drawing the circle however I wanted to sometimes. It's not like he knew where he was pointing me, maybe even, but he gave me possible places to go.
Sigh. You of all people should know, there are no sides.
And yeah. That felt, in a movie like Dune of all things, visionary.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful film. Everything is working in that film. And it gives you the ability to think about yourself, which I'm going to say is a good thing. Like if you can sort of connect to it on that emotional level and start reflecting about who you are and not necessarily, would I marry Princess Aurelian? Like, I don't think that's what you're supposed to be thinking, but I think you're supposed to be thinking, oh, if all these people had these expectations, how would I handle that? Right.
Yeah.
How would I make sure that I was accepted by this community? That's fascinating for a movie as big as it is, as loud as it is, as as many explosions that it has. That there are these moments of quiet reflection where you can insert yourself into the film and say, well, what about me? And what will I know at the end of this.
I love that. And I think that's just a huge part of what makes something feel like art, not just entertainment.
You are going to choose A Trip to Bountiful or Dune 2. And you have said that you want to find a way to make those go together.
I think what I've discovered is that I am so deeply affected by anything that has a large scope. Mm-hmm. This goes from TV, the biography of Miss Jane Pittman. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah.
For her to young, and then being that old woman who had lived to go take a drink at the Whites Only fountain. I was gobsmacked to see a lifetime there. The Trip to Bountiful is a lady who wants to just get back to where she was a girl when she grew up, and nobody's helping her. I'm leaving out so much stuff. And she gets her way. She finds her way. And then with Dune, it's the whole idea of being able to see so far. How, as Paul's mother Jessica says, the beauty and the horror.
You must do what I did. You must drink the water of life. For your mind, it's going to open and you will see. Rosh Hashanah. Your spirit, Jaga.
I can't do the Bene Gesserit witch voice, but...
it's terrifying.
It is. It raises my hackles, but she talks about the beauty and the horror that there is so much of to see. So to me, I guess I'm focusing on the beauty and just the deep feeling of a lifetime. And that's why those two films should be shown together.
Well, let's actually have a filmy question, which is, so you're a fan of the books. You first read the books, I'm going to assume. The truism has long been, the book is always better than the movie. I have to say, the more movies I watch, the more books I read, that's not always true. Ready Player One is one of those that I'm like, thank goodness someone came along and made a script. But what do you think about Dune? When you compare... We're going to talk about a couple of things. One, when you compare the books to the film, what do you think it gains in adaptation?
I think what it gains is just your attachment to the characters that it focuses on. Because there are so many different civilizations that don't even come up in the book. And all the fights between all the big houses, this comes back to more like I can pick three or four people and I can think of them as all living in the same neighborhood and having their conflicts. I attach really deeply and I follow all of their stories really well. There is some magic in a book that you can just sort of, wait a minute, who are those guys? And you flip back a little bit. Oh yeah, okay, they're these guys. And this is that distinctive thing they do.
Well, do you think your emotion or your experience with the film is largely founded on your experience with the books, or do you think that Denis Villeneuve does the work to create a new, more profound emotional experience for you?
In some ways, I felt like he left the emotion making to me in a lot of cases. The characters aren't overwrought or super dramatic, but they show me that they are feeling something inside. I get the little hints, and then I read into that, probably extrapolate.
Your father didn't believe in revenge.
Hell, I do.
If I had just come to it from nothing, I still would have enjoyed the movies, I believe.
Yeah. So in today's day and age, one could have made a mini series, a limited series. One could have done 12 episodes on Dune itself, or even 15. Villeneuve and his people decided to split it in two and have two very long movies. I think there's real benefits in complex books like this in taking them into a streamer and saying, we're going to do a limited series. Mm. But what do you think? What would you, can you envision what that would have looked like? And do you think there would have been benefits there?
Yeah, I think, didn't somebody do sort of a mini series of Dune at some point?
I know right now, I think it's there's HBO Max.
Yeah, the Dune Prophecy, sort of a prequel-ish thing.
Yeah, 1,000 years before. I don't even know if we can call it a prequel. It's like saying Job is a prequel to Revelation. I mean.
I like what he did. I am so there for the long movie because it's well made. And when it's over, I'm thinking, oh, dang, it's over. I did not ever think that this is getting long or boring to me. I like that I got to just sort of live through it.
Dune 2 felt like a fever dream. I mean, I read the books maybe 10, 15 years ago, and it felt like to me, like, here's that. I thought it flowed really well, but I thought if you don't know the story, you just have to give yourself up to this experience.
Yeah. And Paul, even in his beginning dreams, where he's starting to have these dreams of his future, I did have to, like, I've got to stop figuring out who these voices are because it's a female voice. Oh, no, it's a male voice. And later it turns out to be the guy he killed, but now he's still talking with it. You have to let go of logic a little bit.
You need to see.
That said, beautifully shot. So many of those desert sequences are just art on the screen. Just the use of line and shadow. And I really enjoyed it for that reason. Like, visually speaking, I felt like I'm willing to let go because it works on so many levels for me as a piece of art.
If you can make just sand blowing in the wind feel like a mystical experience, with the sparkles and the flares of, I guess, spice is very reflective. Even that is dreamy and beautiful.
Let's talk a little bit more about what the themes are that drew you to this film and why you think those are important themes for you.
Our hero, our character, has what seems like an insurmountable challenge. They have to grow up in unexpected ways. And they discover themselves in a way that when I first read the books, I was in the middle of discovering, like, what am I going to do for a living? Do I like going to school? Do I just all the things you're learning about how to get along with people, who you should have in your life, who you don't have in your life. And so I really related to Paul when I first read it. When I see the movie now, or if I were to reread the books, I would be looking from a viewpoint of choices, and that every choice you make closes some doors, opens others.
It's not that simple.
You have the power to avenge your father, and you're afraid to use it.
So it's a constant changing amount of future paths and possibilities that we're always narrowing. We think we're narrowing it down, but maybe we're also just opening up new ones as well. And so for me, the theme of personal development from the viewpoint of a young person, but now to look back, having lived through the consequences, mostly good, of choices that I made, and then how does that point to the future?
When I turned 40, I remember feeling like I had to let go of a lot of things that I had hoped for. It was a very difficult birthday. Birthdays have never been hard, but that was a hard one. And I had this realization that, you know, when I was in my 20s making decisions, it felt like there was only one path. Like, this is what I'm going to do. This is where I'm headed. I don't know how I'm going to get there, really, but yeah. That's where I'm headed. And when I was 40, looking back, I thought, oh, no, there were so many choices I could have made in so many ways. There were so many paths in front of me, and they all actually might have been great paths. But I had this single-minded focus on the one, and then bitterly thought, and it didn't work. You know, like, I failed somehow. Now at 50, it's more like, well, yeah, what are you going to do?
I probably had a moment pretty close to that. Where I was in one career, and then because of the changes of technology, basically everyone could share your music for free, so I no longer could make a living as a writer, songwriter, musician. And even though that was really the thing that did it, I had that same, like, oh, I did this for over a decade, but now I seem to be failing. Yeah. And in doing something new, even though it turned out to be something I enjoy very much, that was one of the most difficult emotional times for me, was saying goodbye to who I thought I was and was going to do for the rest of my life. I relate.
That question that you get, what do you do? And then you have to say the new thing, and you're like,
yeah, why don't you just... knife through the heart.
Right. Take me out back behind the barn and shoot me. Sorry, suicide jokes. You're on voiceover. Okay, well, so Let's talk about Paul Atreides. He's so interesting to me. One, he has fantastic hair. Played by the young Timothy Chalamet, not that young, actually. I think he was, you know, in his late 20s by the time he was making this film. He has all this incredible pressure. Part of the problem or the sort of conundrum of choosing the next path is his mother has this expectation for him, several expectations for him.
You're so close now. Only one step remains and you will become the Kwisatzatlak.
Stilgar, who is his sort of mentor that he makes with the group, has an expectation for him.
We need you. We need the Lissangal Gaib to lead our people.
You know what I think of all that, Stilgar?
I don't care what you believe. I believe.
Chani, who's played by Zendaya, is going to have an expectation for him.
You promised me you didn't want power.
And he himself feels this expectation to avenge his father's death.
Yeah.
So there's never a moment where you get to say, so Paul, what do you think? You know, do you want to study law or do you want to be a doctor? Right. It's like, here are all the people around him saying to him, you have to do this thing. And they're at odds with each other. And he has to make a choice.
Yeah. All of these expectations. So Stilgar really, really wants to believe that Paul is the Mahdi. So this Messiah to come from the outside world. But they joke about it when they want to just kick him in the desert. He said, well, I've seen some signs. He might be. And they're like, oh, again? So yeah. Stilgar seems like somebody who's always just, he is so hopeful that anyone who looks like they might be the right person, he's there right. for it. And you see it sort of cross his mind through his eyes. By the way, what a great actor he is.
Oh, I love Javier Bardem. He's fantastic.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, if there's anyone that I never even thought, oh, another actor has come on the screen playing a part, it was him. Later, I realized, oh, yeah, he is an actor playing this part. They didn't get the real Stilgar, but that came as a shock to me somehow. And you can see when he brings Paul and Lady Jessica into Siege Tabor for the first time, and everyone's saying, a witch, imposter, yeah. kill them all. But this one guy says, they don't know what they're saying. Lisan al-Gaib, this is our one from the outside. And you really see this shift in his eyes like, wow, there's someone who is open to the possibility.
Well, that scene is actually really nicely done because it's going to parallel that final scene, which looks very similar. They go into this big, I'm going to call it a wadi. They go into this yeah. place where everyone is gathered, and then Paul has to sort of convince them. So visually, they parallel each other extremely well, and they're outsiders, and we have to have Stilgar stand up for them and argue for them to be accepted. But at the end, Paul has now grown enough and he's kind of realized how to, I don't want to say manipulate, but maybe inspire, how to inspire these people that he's going to speak on his own behalf and lay out what it is that he wants to accomplish, including, I'm doing this because I am my father's son and I'm going to avenge my father.
This is my father's ducal signet. I am Paul Muad'Dib Atreides, Duke of Arrakis.
And when he does decide, I will do what must be done, which is sort of throwing away any vestiges of his old life. And then he starts speaking very forcefully and saying things that are quite shocking, and he's not following the rules of the council. And you see everybody in his life reacting badly to him. Johnny's like, oh, you idiot. You're just you. Don't pretend you're this person. She doesn't believe a bit of it. You see Stilgar just with this light glowing in his eyes, like, I think I found my Messiah. And you see his mother, too, doing that like, oh, not so much, you know?
Right.
And so they're all seeing him as this person they have trained and actually have some control over. Every one of them has now lost control of him.
Yeah.
You see that in their eyes, and he absolutely is taking charge.
Take my life, Uzul.
It is the only way.
I'm pointing the way!
Slow down.
Unara sot! Udao fisihi! Ni freebit! Kumuni!
When you told me, like, oh, I want to talk about the different paths that we could choose, and I was rewatching it, I was waiting for an articulation of that from the film. I was surprised it came like 2 hours into the film where Paul finally says he's taken this drug. He's basically done acid and he's seen the universe. And he comes back and he says, I can see a path.
I see possible futures all at once. Our enemies are all around us. And in so many futures, they prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through.
He's had these great visions of the universe, which I would almost call like a spiritual epiphany, except what he's saying is, I can see a way through, a narrow way through, but that's how we survive, and I get revenge to destroy their opponents. It's not like he sees a way for the good of all the universe and chooses that self-sacrificingly. Right. So in a way, I've heard some people say that Denis Villeneuve got it right because Paul does not necessarily become a hero. He may even be sort of a bad guy, a tyrant.
Consider what you're about to do, Paul Atreides.
Silence!
Abomination.
He keeps saying, I can't make this choice because billions will die.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow he convinces himself, well...
Yeah, whose billions? My billions? Their
exactly.
But interesting that he sees in the future how many will die, but that it will be less than might otherwise die. I pick that out as a threat of good, a threat of humanity, that he seems to see that. Like, there is no way out of this where horrible things don't happen, but maybe fewer horrible things will happen. And that ties in with what his mother said. You have to drink the water of life, Paul.
For your mind, it's going to open and you will see. Rosh Hashanah. Your spoiljaka.
We're used to, in our Hollywood films, having a happy ending for the hero that includes getting the girl. And this is a movie where he literally lets go of the girl. You know, his mother's going to say to him, you can't become involved with Chani because you have to make the most advantageous marriage possible. And I think if you haven't read the books, you might think to yourself, and of course he will, right? That's how Hollywood works, right? You know, I'm going to follow my heart, Mom. And he instead is like, oh, yep, I see the most advantageous marriage and I'm going to take it. And I think for me, that's actually was the most emotional moment in the entire film because I was on Chani's side going, oh my gosh, you know, I can't believe that she's got to, in a public space, watch this man that she loves turn away from her and choose something completely cynical.
I'll take the hand of your daughter. She will remain safe and we will rule together over the empire.
I don't know that I cried, but I just had like this big reaction in my chest. Yeah. Like,
same thing. Yeah. This big clenching lump. Can we talk about the music?
Yes. You're going to know more about it than I do.
It's music that doesn't feel like music throughout the film score, especially like the Harkonnens. It's just these big blasting industrial sounds.
Yes.
And then there's these hints of kind of Arabic desert music. And so I thought the fact that Hans Zimmer did it, who also did The Lion King.
Interstellar. And he's done a lot of those scores where, like, it's more of a tone and a texture.
So I love that I never thought, oh, and now the violins are swelling. It's the love theme. There is a love theme, but it's kind of a desert flute that plays alone as we hear sand and spice rushing by us. It was genius, the way he kind of did not do a traditional movie score, but like you said, textures and mood, there's always definitely a feeling there. So Frank Herbert does a great job setting us up, I think, for religious expectation, because we're hearing things that sort of seem Arabic or maybe related to Islam in some way.
North African.
Yeah, And the Bene Gesserit, they're like the warrior nuns.
I want to go to the religion stuff because I think it's really important. There's the line from Princess Aurelian, played by Florence Pugh. She says to her father, "You're not going to win this because you don't understand how important religion is."
"Repression only makes a religion flourish. You'll only end up humiliating yourself."
"You underestimate my sadaka."
"You underestimate the power of faith."
But she's not necessarily saying religion is good. Religion leads to an ethical society where people make good choices and look out for each other. She's just saying religion is going to impact how these people act and what choices they make, and you don't seem to get it. And the movie seems to actually conflate fundamentalism with religion, or the only expression of religion is fundamentalism that we see. And that's embodied by, like, oh, those fundamentalists in the South. We don't know exactly what they're going to do, but, you know,
They're all waiting for their Messiah.
At the same time, then you have the Bene Gesserit, who represent another kind of religious expression, secret society, where they're there to maintain order. And Chani, of course, is going to be the person who keeps crying out, like, this is how we are enslaved, is through religion and through these prophecies of Messiah.
"This prophecy is how they enslave us!"
So as a religious person, I wonder what you were thinking about this portrayal of religion.
I have to say that enough bad has been done in the name of religion over the years, usually by people seeking political gain.
You weren't power, surprised?
I thought, well, this is telling a true tale.
Right.
But I don't feel personally threatened or like, oh, they shouldn't say bad things about people trying to be good, because I wasn't sure who was trying to be good, really, in this movie.
Yeah, well, that goes back to your comment about Paul. Like, he's going to make a choice, but it's not necessarily going to be a choice that is going to make him a good person.
Yeah, or like, in the next life, I will be happy that I have done the following things because of the consequences that come to me. It's not even anything like that. And I don't know if this is religious or not, but I latched onto it, which is Paul is now talking with his unborn sister, who's still this tiny little embryo.
"Sister, father is dead. Shouldn't you go back to the stars? Be with him?"
And I thought, what is he saying? Is that just a metaphor? You know, wherever you came from, in my own tradition, there is a pre-existence. And maybe that's why that hit me. That's one of those doors that if you open, you can't go back until you go through another one, which is to die. I just spent a little time thinking about that. That had, because of my own faith tradition, some personal religious relevance. Do you think this part is religious? The whole stuff that happens to the minds with spice. I mean, I'm thinking of entheogens and, you know, plant medicine, as it's referred to today, people having experiences where they feel like the boundaries between them and the earth they live on dissolve temporarily, and they felt this oneness. Is that religious, or how did it strike you?
The wonderful thing about the Fremens is that they've managed to thrive in this desert. And I have to say, the thing that most impressed me were those suits that they wore that, like, that completely make use of any kind of liquid or moisture that comes out of them. It's going to filter it and going to allow them to, like, keep drinking. And so to me, that was like, oh, this is in stark contrast to, as a Westerner, the way we think of the world, which is we have to dominate it to make it better. And by better, we mean I should have access to everything that I want. And if I want to waste it, that's my prerogative. And I don't have to think about the fact that they're are all these other people who need water as well? This is a long answer, Steve.
No, I'm liking it. I'm taking notes.
Oh, okay, good. But, you know, like we can think of indigenous societies or great nations people or other places on the earth where instead of dominating the planet or dominating their resources, they think of this as a part of the earth and I will make do and make use of what is available to me, but I'm also not going to waste anything.
Yeah, you know? And even have some responsibility for it.
They have those huge reservoir that they're stockpiling liquid into. And when someone dies, they put their bodily liquids into that place and then it's going to somehow filter. And this was a holy place for them because this is where there's water, but there's the water of the people and they're calling that drug water of life. So just this reverence they had. Anytime someone cries, don't waste your water on emotions, right? Like this is, you know, be more respectful of where we live by not crying or by not vomiting, right? Like, you know, Lady Jessica
Don't let it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when she's there looking at that giant container.
So many souls.
Uts. Never give your water away, not even for the dead.
I don't know if it's religious, but definitely a something like that, an emotional moment for her. And as far as religion, can we talk about the god of Arrakis or Dune? Shai-Hulud. That's God, is the giant sandworm.
The sandworms. Had they never had the idea before this to ride the sandworms to attack? Had they never had that idea before?
You're asking why they don't just get the eagles to fly Frodo right to Mount Doom.
Yes.
Because we wouldn't have three books.
Good point. The exigencies of the market is what you're telling me is the answer to that question. What I love about those sandworms is how unattractive they are. Like this is something that only in that culture can be revered. Any other person or group coming into the planet is just like horrified and they want to get rid of them. But these people, having had to have that relationship, are like, well, this is how you handle this and this is how you live with this. It's not a sense of who's going to dominate who or who's going to exterminate who.
Okay. I realize this is your podcast, but I have questions for you.
Yeah, keep talking. But,
and I'm asking myself this same question. What did Denis Villeneuve want people to feel when they finished the film? And then finally, Heather, what did you feel?
I think Denis Villeneuve, he has done Arrival, Sicario, Blade Runner, Prisoners. I think he's very much interested in what does a moral life look like? And when we're in these really impossible situations, how do we make the best choice? And I think he wants us to be thinking about that. And Dune is a good vehicle for that. As you said, Paul could have made the choice of, I'm just going to build a small life, quote unquote, small life here with Chani and be grateful that I survived. And I'm going to become part of their society and I'm going to help defend the people who've welcomed me into their village. He could have made that choice. But instead, he makes the choice of, no, I'm going to rule the entire universe.
But he seems pushed into making that choice.
But he also embraces it. I mean, I think one of the notes you'd made earlier was once he makes the decision, he's, as we say, all in. Like, I'm part of your band of rebels who's going to blow up spice. Let's do it. Like, I'm ready to go. And then he's like, oh, we're going to go south. I'm going to like preach to the fundamentalists. Let's do it.
Let's get the emperor here and take over the universe.
Exactly. Oh, you need me to marry the daughter? Sure. I'm going to marry the daughter. I mean, Florence Pugh is easy on the eyes.
She is a lovely person. With, by the way, a voice that from every time I hear it, I think, oh, say more. She's got a great voice.
In the shadows of Arrakis lie many secrets. But the darkest of them all may remain
So I think that's what Denis Villeneuve, based on his other films, is interested in. How do you make the choices that you make? And even if you can make those choices, should you be making those choices, right? But what do you think Frank Herbert wanted?
I thought he had things to say about colonialism.
Yeah.
He had things to say about politics. And maybe he just wanted to just express and work out his own ideas about all of those things in kind of a playground that wasn't just, I'm talking to my friends about we should take better care of the environment or should we be so dependent on these oil-producing countries? Right. Those sound like pretty academic but boring questions. He found a really interesting way to work them out in his mind. It does give lots of room to think about religion because there are people who are seeking after what they are seeking for different reasons. And for me, it says it's not so much that it's good or bad. It's just like, what is my motivation to do? Am I doing this to be seen as a good person? Or have I become someone whose first impulse is to help or to reach out or whatever it might be, just because that is my nature and what I want to do?
Denis Villeneuve has spoken in several interviews about the movies that influenced his work on Dune Part 2, like Lawrence of Arabia, Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ, the Japanese anime film Akira, and Bergman's Persona. But here are several films that I thought of as I watched the film, and that I recommend to you. I thought much about Guillo Pontecorvo's 1966 The Battle of Algiers, especially during the sequence of Fremen attacks on spice machines. Battle of Algiers blurs the boundaries of documentary and fiction film as it recounts the fight for Algerian independence against the French, using handheld cameras and many non-professional actors. In fact, some people are playing themselves in the very streets where the strikes and armed conflict took place. The screenplay was based on the writing of Sadi Yassef, one of the freedom fighters who eventually became a leader in the independent Algerian government. One of the film's most gripping sequences is when the male Muslim leadership recruit women to place bombs in French public spaces, terrorizing the French colonials. The film was banned in France, but years later, studied by the U.S. government as it geared up for the 2003 invasion of Iraq. I showed this film to students during the first years of the Iraqi and Afghanistan wars, and they were outraged at the strategies of the Algerians. Yet, as I watched Dune Part 2 almost 20 years later, I wondered who those students would have identified with in Villeneuve's sci-fi extravaganza. Dune Part 2 is like a biopic of a once-and-future king. We're shown the events that space historians will one day craft into how Paul Atreides became the future emperor, and the film style already swathes those events in legend. The trajectory Paul is on is one of innocence turned to political machination. If you're into biopics and political educations, you should definitely watch Spike Lee's 1992 Malcolm X, which follows an American orphan from his impoverished and unloved teenage years through foster homes and prison, into religious community and marriage and the public eye, and lastly, to Mecca for a final self-revelation. It's a heartbreaking, fascinating, and riveting film about a man despised and rejected by white America who learns brotherhood and left me truly humbled. Love the ambivalent nature of Paul's transformation, the haunting question of, is he a good guy or not? Well, John Ford's The Searchers from 1956 is about a bitterly motivated protagonist, played by John Wayne, hot for revenge, who spends years searching for his abducted niece, and by the end of this movie, you know for sure that this is no good guy. While this film is dressed up as a Western and shot on location in Monument Valley, it's a look at how racism and American racial politics are destroying families, communities, and individuals. Oh, and if you're a Star Wars fan, you'll see its influence on the original 1977 film, which was also influenced by the Dune books, and which, in turn, influenced the film adaptions of Dune. Do you guys say adaptation or adaption? Adaption. Adaption. I use them anyway. That's our show today. VoiceOver is edited by Aaliyah Alexander and is a production of BYU Radio. I'm your host, Heather Bigley.